Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Today, I'm going to start off with a little bit of a rant, which you'll forgive me, I hope, but there have been a number of experiences lately that are fairly illustrative. And then I'm going to bring you some news you can use. And then we'll have some history lessons. It's been a very historical week here in California history, and it's continuing to be. Well, June has some really historical milestones. So just as Giant Steps, which comes after this program, often celebrates the birthdays, we're going to celebrate some important days in American history, and with an emphasis, a little bit of an emphasis anyway, on healthcare. But first, my rant. I heard someone tell me the other day, and I just heard it again, that the United States is a failed state. But I don't think that's true. But I do think there are many people out there who would like us to think that it's a failed state so that we, you know, give up, not vote, circle the wagons, and just focus on getting by. Showing up at the polls is one of the many things that works well in this country. But the healthcare system is a failed state. And sometimes I get so discouraged wrestling with it in a country that worships capitalism because at the very least, the least competitive and most unmarket-driven system there is. Let's go back to first principles. The purpose of a healthcare system is to deliver healthcare to the people. How are we doing on that? A second purpose of a healthcare system is to ensure equitable distribution of social resources, social benefits, and good stewardship of these social resources that are allocated to healthcare so that we obtain the goal of raising community health in the most effective and efficient fashion possible. Well, we're not even getting a C on equitable distribution. We're lagging badly in raising community health, with one exception that I'll come to in a moment. As far as effective and efficient, that is an F minus. Is there such a thing as an F minus? Well, we're getting it on efficient and cost effective. We got a little taste of what actual competence looks like from a healthcare system with the mass vaccinations that just happened. There were hiccups, there were distribution problems, there were all the sorts of things you would expect, but we've actually done really well compared to our neighbors, compared to other countries that have similar standards of living and who made process errors that were much, much deeper than any of the errors that we read about in our newspapers. Here's just an example, and I just want to give a shout out to Dignity and PAMP, but you probably don't realize how many, if not all of the doctors and nurses who gave you your vaccinations were volunteers. And they didn't receive any payment for those many hours of work. And our healthcare system does this consistently. From the insurance level to the pharmacology level, it exploits the generosity and the ethics of its healthcare workers. These are good people who went into healthcare to help others. And so, despite the fact that they're not being treated fairly, I think people, skilled workers, should be paid for their time. They do it anyway. Did you know that there's no collective bargaining for healthcare workers? In fact, it's statutorily prohibited for doctors to organize, which drives me crazy because organized labor is one of the ways you talk back to big business. And the doctors, if they could legally organize, would be able to really make fundamental changes and reforms in the way insurance behaves, mistreating both patients and doctors. The thing that aggravates me the most about our healthcare system is the fact that the price for anything is not really the price. I had a patient just yesterday who has PPO insurance and has foot pain and ankle pain for many years after an injury with multiple surgery. She recently flared it up, and she really needs an MRI of her foot and ankle to figure out what's going on. The orthopedic surgeon she's seen wants her to get it. But the insurance companies are turning her down. And this is a case that happens a lot. The insurance companies are trying to weasel out of paying for it. Because this was originally a workman's comp case, they're pointing fingers at each other, saying, well, it's your problem. And the other says, no, it's your problem. And this is typical of what we see with workman's compensation and commercial employer-based health insurance when there's a problem that arguably could be attributed to a work-related injury. Even if that's been old and signed off, they still get into this territorial dispute. Meanwhile, the patient gets tossed back and forth like a hot potato and doesn't get the care they need. Now, I want to say, when I talk about the price is not the price, this patient is middle class. So she asked her insurance company what her cost would be for the MRI and was told it would be $4,000, which is more than she can afford. However, if she goes over to Los Gatos or other places in Santa Clara County, her MRI was going to cost us about $450 if she comes in as a cash-paying patient and doesn't use her insurance. Well, that's a great deal for the insurance company, isn't it? Deny the care, put the person through multiple appeals, then finally force her to spend her own money because she's desperate, and pocket that much more of your profits. And speaking of insurance company profits, we're not going into big pharma, okay? That's another issue, but you know my opinion on that. But insurance company profits. Now, Obamacare helped many people. I'm very grateful for the elimination of pre-existing conditions and the provisions to allow college students to remain under their parents' insurance. But it has been very onerous for small businesses and small entrepreneurs like myself. Anyone of age greater than 50 who has their own business has had very high increases in their health care costs under Obamacare. Meanwhile, since 2014, insurance company profits skyrocketed because there were specific provisions put into Obamacare that allowed insurance companies to increase their rates and more than compensate for the insurance cost of actually doing preventative medicine, which, believe it or not, prior to 2014, insurance companies were not actually required to cover preventative medicine. Like, that's smart. So people can't get screening for a disease because it isn't covered by the only insurance they can afford, which shouldn't be allowed to be sold in the first place if the feds weren't asleep on the switch for two decades. So they have to wait until they get sick before their health insurance kicks in. Then they've got a diagnosis. Of course, then they've got a diagnosis. So it's too late for prevention. They've got the disease. They've got hypertension. They've got diabetes. And you don't go back from those. Whereas if you have pre-hypertension or pre-diabetes, you have an opportunity to reverse this slide into an actual disease. But you have to find those people who need that intervention. And then, of course, you have to fund the intervention. Would this save the system money? If it was a global system and the feedback loops were functional, you bet it would. But those people who had to wait till they got the disease before their health insurance kicked in, well, then, of course, the following year, their insurance cost increased and they're trapped in their job, or they're trapped where they're trapped with that insurance company, because now they have a pre-existing condition and no one else will take them. All right, we fixed that one, maybe, unless, of course, Congress reverses it. But the only word for this is insane. So if we want to talk failed state, that's what a failed state looks like. I had a really interesting conversation with a patient, and I just want to mention to you, her situation is not at all rare. She had her house power washed, and there was a lot of peeling paint on it. And so all the paint came off of her house, which was built in the 1950s, I believe, and scattered all over her garden and her yard, little chips of paint. Now, the problem is that her house was built in the 1950s, which means that all of that paint has lead in it. So her garden beds, her flower beds, and her garden beds were contaminated. And over the next couple of years, those little bits of, just like microplastics, those little bits of paint are going to be, well, they're going to break down and they're going to get into the soil and they're going to be absorbed by plants. So this is not a good look, right? I told her, I'm sorry, you're going to have to abandon your garden beds. But then I did a little bit of research, and we talked about this. Let's just take a moment. If you have a house that was built before 1978, the odds are excellent that it was painted with paint that had lead in it. All right. That's exactly what they had. Lead paint. When you take that paint and you scrape it down, when you do anything that you need to do for maintenance of the property, you're potentially contaminating yourself. Now, if you have the bad luck to have land that had a factory or had a gas station on it, or you're near a road, there's other issues. I was in LA a couple of years ago, and I saw that many of the homeless people in the old Skid Row area of LA were planting gardens on the little strips of land, but they're right by a busy road. So yeah, they can grow some food, but yeah, that food is going to be contaminated. And once lead is in the soil, it doesn't biodegrade, and it persists for thousands of years. So as I said, it's lead-based paint and auto emissions, but there's hope, okay? And that's what I'm here to give you, not a gloom and doom story, but news you can use, okay? Your county extension office can help you test your soil to see if you have contamination. If tests show that your property has some lead contamination, but not high levels, then don't grow leafy vegetables or root vegetables in that soil until the levels go down. Fruiting vegetables like tomatoes, peppers, squash, cucumbers, peas, and beans absorb less lead. The other thing is you probably want to keep your kids from playing around in the areas with the heaviest contamination, which is going to be right along that driveway. People install raised beds, but you can also plant plants. And so I'm here to talk to you about bioremediation. Phytoremediation is another word for that. Some plants are so effective at phytoremediation that they can be smelted after being used to clean up water-soluble metals at extremely contaminated sites, and the metals can be extracted back from the plants. That's crazy. Okay? So cost-effective green technology uses plants to vacuum the heavy metals through the roots. And certain plants are metal hyperaccumulators. I'm going to tell you about 7 plants that are very good for pulling all sorts of metals out of the soil. One of them, kind of the Pac-Man of the plant world here, is actually beautiful. And unfortunately, you just can't eat the seeds. And that plant, top of the list, is sunflowers. Sunflowers are really good at extracting a whole host of metals. I'm going to read you the list. Lead, uranium, strontium, cesium, chromium, cadmium, copper, nickel, and 2 that you'd probably want to be eating, magnesium and zinc. But hey, you can buy supplements for those, but you can remediate your soil. Remember, you got to pull up the entire sunflower, and remember not to compost it or eat the seeds, but you can use that to clean. Another plant that's very effective is ornamental cabbage. You've seen those in the wintertime. They're green with the purple center, and then eventually they get real tall. In one study in Maine, the ornamental cabbage was used in a very heavily contaminated industrial site. And after one growing season, the levels of lead in the soil dropped from 984 milligrams per kilogram of soil to 644 milligrams per kilogram. So that's a 30% decrease. And you can imagine if you did that for 5 years, you might be able to get the levels down to the acceptable. These are easy to grow, and essentially, you can put them in the ground in this area. You can put them in the ground and let them grow all year. When they get big and they bolt, you just pull them out and replant them. They're a very good way to detoxify soil. And you can also plant them between your garden rows. Another plant that's very good is rapeseed, which someone gave me some of that. That's what they make canola oil from. Boy, did that grow well. It was totally a weed. I'm really sorry I planted it. It was not what I was hoping for in terms of a greens crop, but yep, oops, I made a mistake. That's what you do when you're gardening. You learn from your mistakes. Another pretty plant looks a little bit like chives. It's called Sea Pink Thrift. And this loves to grow in dry, sandy soil. We're heading into summer. And just a little gardening recommendation, get some of that silicon stuff that absorbs water and plant that around the roots, and you'll be able, any water and drip system, it'll hold on to all the drip water for you. And hydrate it first when you plant the plant, but then a minimal amount of watering. And even though it's a new plant, you'll be able to keep it alive for the first summer. Ragweed, also really great at pulling metals out of the soil, particularly lead, but kind of obnoxious because ragweed causes pollen issues. Mustard greens. Now, here in California, we have hillsides and hillsides of mustard greens, and those have been shown to be quite effective at eliminating lead. They're one of the hyper accumulators, but they do accumulate it in their roots, so you have to pull the roots out. An aquatic bioaccumulator, metal hyperaccumulator, is duckweed. A duckweed, you'll find that floating on still water, on lakes. It's very, very good at pulling nitrogen and phosphates out of water. So if you're near, like, for example, in Watsonville, Pinto Lake has eutrophic problems. They get too many phosphates washing in from the agricultural areas. And then the duckweed will suck that up. But it also creates a problem in that it sucks up a lot of oxygen and kills off the plant life. So you've got to know what you're doing. And I'm not recommending that you plant duckweed unless you really have a big contamination issue. I'm going to go to an email that I had this last week. And by the way, during the week, just go to askdrdawn.com and click the Contact Us button, and I'll be able to help you with that. So our first email is in reference to last week's show. It's from Aaron in Santa Cruz. Aaron writes, regarding eating salad before a meal to stretch the stomach and increase satiety. And if you didn't hear about this trick, please go back to last week's show, because it's all about stretch receptors when we talk about appetite. Well, not all about, but it's a big piece. Not blood sugar, which surprised me. Anyway, Aaron continues, any reason I can't sub chia and flax for salad? Well, Aaron, probably not. But you're going to need to consume a fair amount of it, because it is more dense than the salad greens. So you're going to have potentially some problems with farting and maybe some diarrhea, because you might take more stuff that you can absorb. The nice thing about the greens is they're super high in fiber. Also, if you're going to use flaxseed, you really want to grind the flaxseed fresh and not eat it as whole flaxseed. And also, if you grind it ahead of time, it loses a lot of its value as a nutrient. So my suggestion here is freeze it in little ice cube trays and drop it in the coffee grinder and grind it and use that for your meal. Mix that in with something, stir it into a soup. You could mix it in with mashed potatoes that way, or whatever it is that you're also eating. Next email goes out to Patricia in Santa Cruz. Probiotics after antibiotics. Hi, Dr. Dawn. A friend is having knee replacement surgery and will get a massive dose of antibiotics. Yes, she will. I can't remember what specific probiotics would be good for her to take after the surgery. Her husband had the same surgery and antibiotics a while ago and had bad diarrhea for a week. Thanks so much, as always. Well, you're very welcome, Pat. And here's the scoop. The advice that I give on probiotics is predicated on a number of things. So I don't know your friend's particular clinical situation or what sort of intestinal diseases she might have. This advice is not intended for people who are taking high-dose proton pump inhibitors, which turn off all the stomach acid. And that's because in that situation, this might backfire. And I would not want someone in that situation to be taking it. I use a mix of bifidobacterium and lactobacillus, and a good, just to give you a brand name, Jarrow, J-A-R-R-O-W, they do not advertise on my website, by the way, has a product called Ultradophilus, which has about 50, that's 50 billion organisms. The other thing that I always recommend that someone take the night before or the day before their surgery, or maybe starting a few days before their surgery, is start taking Saccharomyces boulardii. This is a beneficial yeast. A brand name of that is Flor Restore, And oddly enough, that is the only probiotic that's actually on the formulary at Dominican Hospital, my local hospital. That may have changed. Last time I tried to give it, I could, but hey, whoever's on the formulary committee maybe has made a different decision. In any event, I feel that probiotics are extremely safe, and I highly recommend their use. The dose for someone who's just getting a big wonking dose of intravenous antibiotics at the time of their surgery would be 50 billion three times a day for about 2 weeks after their surgery. If the person actually gets diarrhea, you can go to 100 billion four times a day until you get the diarrhea under control. And I found it to be very helpful. But you're also going to be taking that 500 milligrams of S. Boulardii. And that's because you want to avoid the dreaded Clostridium difficile. This is a toxin related bacteria, and it's basically an opportunistic infection. We're going to be talking about those as part of our history lesson. So let's move into the history lessons. This was something that I saw last week, and I didn't get to it last week's show, but it's about June 5th, 1981. We had a really important history of medicine anniversary on June 5th. That happens to be my birthday, so the irony was totally not, was like so strong, because June 5th, 1981 was the day that the first article regarding an unusual cluster of young homosexual males with opportunistic infections was published. And this was published in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which is kind of one of the early warning publications, if you will, that gets sent out to doctors if you subscribe, and also really rapidly promulgated. And it's epidemiology. It's what we're seeing, what's cropping up, what to watch for. Because when someone comes in with a fever and a rash, it really makes a difference if you're living in Colorado versus living in the Caribbean, because what you could have is drastically different, and we have to think about what to check for. So getting back to the irony there, June 5th, 1981 was just about the time I graduated from college, and very shortly before I posted my first medical school applications. And boy, was I stepping into a learning situation. So the original article was written by a doctor in Southern California, UCLA, my old alma mater. It was the first article to describe the syndrome. There were 5 case reports at several different hospitals, and all of these young men between 29 and 36 were hospitalized with a very rare opportunistic lung infection that literally never seen in adults who hadn't had massive chemotherapy and a complete collapse of their immune system. It just wasn't seen. And suddenly we were seeing it. It's actually a yeast infection of the lungs. And, you know, those are quite rare. They also had an infection actively with something called cytomegalovirus, and they all had candida in their mouths. These all turned out to be very, very important aspects for the history. Also, Dr. Gottlieb was able to ascertain that the patients didn't know each other, they hadn't been in contact with each other, and they didn't have any common contacts. None of their sexual partners had similar maladies that they knew. They were also very, very abnormal in their bloodstream. They were profoundly deprived of antigens and mitogens, antibodies and other things you would normally expect to find, including, among other things, antibodies against candida, which everybody has. About 4 months later, The Lancet published an article about Kaposi's sarcoma, a rare cancer, usually only seen in elderly Mediterranean men, that was popping up in the same population group. I can't describe to you how strange this was, particularly as more and more cases began to accumulate. And it was very clear that homosexuality in some patients was a factor. What we didn't know was about the IV drug user connection, and other individuals would subsequently be identified as having risk factors, and other manifestations would suddenly be identified things you wouldn't have thought of. Like, for example, precancerous changes on pap smears turned out to be a symptom that had to be thought about. Frequent vaginal yeast infections, another. But we didn't understand it. Now, that was the height of the club era, the bathhouse era. A lot of people would go to discos and use these little poppers, which were amyl nitrate. They made you feel wonderful for about 30 seconds, I guess. Never tried it myself. But we thought, well, maybe that's, if you use too many of those, it could be a problem. We didn't know about whether it was aerosolized. We didn't know how it was spread. And you can't imagine how scary that is to be in medical school facing a very severe, deadly, frightening disease and not know how to protect yourself. And we didn't have a test for it. You know, we had a COVID test really, really quickly. Yeah, some false starts, but we're talking about months. Okay, we didn't get our first HIV test for 4 years after this first article was published. So we had surrogate markers. We had CD4 and CD8 ratios, the T helper, T suppressor ratio. We had whether you had hepatitis B. People were prevented from giving blood. We started thinking, well, you know, we think it's bloodborne. That seems to make sense. Body fluids, anyway. You've all lived through COVID, so you understand. You hypothesize. You think, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's aerosol, maybe it's droplets. You test, you figure it out. It takes a while. The cycle of testing and figuring it out has gone so much more quickly with this. I'm so proud of how the science has developed. And I had a front row seat on this, folks. So I can tell you, it was a horrible disease. It killed about 37 million people worldwide. It's been a terrible thing, particularly in Africa, where different sexual practices have made it, well, fertile women get it in Africa, which means you have babies getting it. And that's, well, you can't imagine how devastating that diagnosis is. But we're maybe looking at the light at the end of the tunnel. A major study was published that showed that antiretroviral drugs can completely prevent the sexual transmission of this virus. The research, you may have seen the PrEP ads, but basically a drug called Truvada, if it's taken regularly, prevents people from spreading this virus. It was an 8-year study, 1,000 gay male couples, and it was 100% effective at preventing HIV-positive men from transmitting HIV using sex without a condom. That's really impressive. Do you think that should be free? Do you think that as a society we would like to fund that? What about, does it work for people who are sharing needles, who are using IV drugs? Well, the answer is that and needle exchange would go a very long way to eliminating HIV. Now, it took a long time before we had even one drug, and that drug was AZT, and it came out in, I believe, 1988 or 87. Let me double check. Yeah, 1987. So we had the test for 3 years, then we suddenly had a drug. And I remember in our community, one very heroic physician named Arnold Leff, who I will always admire as one of my heroes, because he got in there and he learned everything he could, and he took care of the AIDS community in this county early on. And he taught us other doctors what we needed to know about these drugs as they became available. And he taught me one really important thing, which is, yeah, you get the new drug and it works in the lab and it maybe works in that study. But what you don't get is you don't get who's it going to hurt, and you don't get how it plays well with others, because in all of these studies, there's no mixing of drugs. So you can't know how it's going to interact. And you certainly don't know about long-term side effects. One of the long-term side effects of the cocktail of drugs we currently use is a compound called lipodystrophy. And that is something that is really good not to get, but hey, it's better to use a agent that does something for the disease and take your lumps. Another thing, and I want to, anyone out there who is on these drugs, if you're male, I want to tell you one of the emerging phenomenon now 20, 30 years out, is we're seeing odd plaques, peripheral peripheral artery disease, unusual accumulations of cholesterol, not necessarily in the heart, but in other limbs, and we're seeing it 20 or 30 years sooner than we would expect to see it. So I want to talk for just a moment about that and remind doctors that that's happening. And you all know how to check for peripheral artery disease. So if someone in that age group comes in with classic symptoms of claudication, then you're really going to want to do something about it. Okay, we have a caller. Hello there, Pat. This is Dr. Dawn, and I believe you're on the air.
I have a follow-up question about the probiotics.
All right.
My friend's fortunately having her surgery tomorrow morning, so I don't know that she'll be able to get the Espulardia in time to take that. Is that going to make a difference? I mean, you know, obviously it'd be great if she could.
Well, since you can't preload, that's a best practice. But yes, it will make a difference because the die-off of her gut bacteria and the transformation will occur over 24 to 48 hours. And the C. difficile, that's the thing we're trying to avoid, is kind of the last man standing, so to speak. And so as soon as she's able to take oral things, first of all, you know, try to do it on the straight, on the up and up Florastore. If it's on the hospital formulary, that's Saccharomyces boulardii, and you can do it all official and above board. Nowadays, most people with major orthopedic surgeries are going home within 12 to 36 hours, often very, very soon. And I recently listened to, I believe it was the Grand Rounds. No, it wasn't. It was the Institute for Functional Medicine, AIC, and I didn't talk about it last week. But basically, at that conference, we had a doctor come on who talked about early mobilization, literally getting people up on their feet within 30 minutes, and also not using opiates at all, using local blocks and spinal and sedation, but getting people up right away and mobilizing them. People were able to go home sooner. They were avoiding all the complications like the constipation and the falls that can be so critical. So it's a real sea change in the surgical approach that we're seeing. And I love to see science-driven progress in my field. It makes me feel all warm and fuzzy. So anyways, yeah. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, so if she starts taking it, you know, afterwards...
As soon as she can, and it will help. It will help.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And how often would she take that?
Just 500 milligrams a day should be enough for the Espulardia.
Okay.
It won't hurt to take
great.
It twice a day, you know, but there's not a lot of science on the dosing. There's a lot of science on the safety, however.
But then also take the other.
I recommend that. They are better at controlling. See, this controls, the Espulardia controls the C. diff, but the other types of antibiotic-associated diarrhea come from the massive die-off, and that's where those high doses of a mix of lactobacillus and bifidobacterium really shine. I also use these for traveler's diarrhea with, you know, great success. But you have to use those really high doses. And, you know, when you say tell somebody to take 100 billion four times a day, you know, that almost sounds like the federal budget.
Anyway. Okay, well, thanks so much. I'll pass this info along to her.
Very good. And thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
So let's continue with the history lessons. We talked about the anniversary of HIV. Just yesterday, we had Mask Freedom Day here in California. This was, I hope, not a premature proclamation, but I know that the tension between the economy and safety has been one of the dances that we've had to dance, and it's been, contact improvisation, hasn't it? And not to mention contact precautions, which I am encouraging you to continue to do. And when I say contact precautions, I'm talking about social distancing. If you're not wearing a mask, if you are in a mixed group, I think it's still good to have a mask on you. And if it's for singing and things like that, I wouldn't be in a room with people that I didn't know for sure were vaccinated right now, particularly if you're going to be doing any shouting or singing. And since we're not really verifying that when you go to a game or a large performance, and we know that there are people who are what we call in the prisoner's dilemma, we call them defectors. So they're people who haven't chosen to protect others. So I think in those situations, I'm still wearing my mask. Now, we're talking now etiquette. I think it's good to have a mask on you. if you see that someone is really uncomfortable or you go into a business that still has the please wear a mask thing, yeah, do that. Be kind. You know, it really doesn't hurt. By now, you've got to have habituated somewhat to this. This winter, about 2 weeks prior to Thanksgiving, I'm recommending that for transport and large group settings, you go back into a mask. Because you know what? We didn't have a flu season this winter. The masks took care of the flu. And there are colds, and there's all sorts of other things. And once it gets cold and the ambient temperature is below 80, all of these viruses take advantage of that, not just COVID. And the masks worked great. They worked, and we've all got some now. So let's use them. Now, I also wanted to talk just a little bit about the Delta virus. The article that just came out a couple of days ago, I believe it was published in Public Health England, so it was a press release, and it was a study looking at the AstraZeneca vaccine. There was also a second study this week looking at the Pfizer-BioNTech, and the Delta virus, if you haven't heard of that, that's the one that's really ravaged India. And it was first identified there, but it's much more likely to cause symptomatic illness and much more likely to cause hospitalization. So you have to be properly vaccinated. But if you are properly vaccinated, you're back at 96% effective for the Delta virus. And two doses of AstraZeneca were also 92% effective. So this was a lot of cases, 14,000 cases in England. The fact is this virus is evil. And as I was mentioning, people who are defectors and who aren't wearing their masks will, in fact, be much more likely to catch this and spread it. And as we move through the summer, I think you want to take a look at the 2020 election map before you decide where you want to go for a vacation. Because here's the scoop. Thursday's CDC report last week showed that the states who had vaccinated at least one shot of the corona vaccines, there are 21. If you look at the top states, the top 25, Joe Biden won 21 of them in the 2020 election. And of the bottom 17, Trump won 16. So you can just go to the blue state, red state. We're seeing a real political divide here. I think it is people's absolute right. If they want to take their chances, you go ahead and take their chances. I resent their not being willing to protect others who are more vulnerable and regret that. But I do agree that they have an absolute right to refuse in our society. Whether they should is a subject for a bioethical debate, which we're not going to go to. It's interesting how it correlates, though. And essentially, the top 25 states for vaccination have an above average percentage of adults 25 or older with a college degree. And the inverse is also true. 21 of the bottom 25 have a below average percentage of adults with a college degree. And I think that people with a college degree probably have better reading comprehension and perhaps have some science background or at least a little bit more. It's interesting because it correlates with education just as much as it correlates with what state you're in. And it also correlates very highly with urban versus rural. So 17 of the top 25 states have a larger share of their residents living in urban areas. Well, you know, that's where you hear the sirens all night long last spring. And if you have a large percentage of people in rural areas, you didn't hear the sirens. You didn't see the hospitals be full in your area, or maybe you did. And if you did, that probably made a difference. It's kind of ironic because we were talking about how well the vaccination was handled. Rural areas actually had a jump start on vaccination because of the way they were distributed last fall in the initial stages when we first got vaccine. I guess it was early December. But as the supply became more available, then rural areas dropped. And that's probably because of both political opinions, but also just the difficulty in getting to a vaccination site. Also, it's about, you know, what's the transportation cost you in time? I had patients who went to Paso Robles who drove, you know, all over the state because that's where they could find a vaccine. It was a bumpy ride, folks, But I think we need to, at least in California, we should give ourselves a high five. We did okay. We have more vaccinated people than any other state. We have so many more vaccinated people. 70% plus have had one vaccine. That's a reason to celebrate. So I'm proposing that June 15th be a freedom celebration next year so we can celebrate that anniversary. And I also want to put in a pitch for Juneteenth, okay? We're talking about freedom from masks. We've talked a little bit about HIV and how we are close 40 years later to maybe having freedom from that. But also, Juneteenth is the anniversary of Texas emancipation. June 19th, 1865 in Texas. Now, I looked it up. The Emancipation Proclamation was signed January 1st, 1863. But, you know, there wasn't any internet back then. There weren't trains to carry the mail, or very few. I think there was a Pony Express, but it took months for mail to arrive. There was also a war going on. That had to affect things. And maybe some foot dragging. I wonder how long after the news got to Texas that it took for that proclamation to come out. I don't actually know the number, and it's probably lost in the sands of time, but it's an interesting question to ask. So our next stories are all sciencey things. Let's go to this next story. Really exciting news about cancer. New research from the University of Salford shows that cutting off the fuel supply can effectively stop the spread of cancer. This is really important because it's the spread of cancer, metastasis, that causes death, not usually the initial primary. Scientists have already known that metastatic cancer cells require an enormous amount of energy, and they represent the fittest, strongest, most adaptive cancer cells. Just like the Delta virus, evolution is taking place within our bodies. And in the case of cancer, the cancer cells that have the highest levels of ATP, that have figured out how to jack up their metabolism, are the ones that do the best. Now, ATP is the universal currency of energy in all living things. The Translational Medicine Laboratory at the University of Salford has used a special sensor to detect ATP in living cells. ATP-high cells were almost five times more metastatic. Ultimately, ATP depletion could prevent metastasis by cutting off the cancer's fuel supply. You know, no juice, no acceleration. And this is where we get into the Warburg effect. The way that cancer cells feed themselves is much more like the way that bacteria feed themselves than the way that normal human cells, healthy human cells, feed themselves. At this University of Salford, they actually used an FDA-approved drug called Sirturo, which was originally designed to inhibit energy production in bacteria. And remember I said it's an FDA-approved drug. Well, they used it to target the fuel supplies of cancer cells. So this was an animal study, but it's fabulous. It blocked metastasis by nearly 85%. And there were no effect on normal cells, which is just huge. Sirturo caused a power failure, but only in cancer cells. Now we need to move this from animal to human, and that's going to take a couple of years. But the fact that the drug is already FDA approved, it's kind of like the remdesivir story. You have a drug that is on the shelf, a drug that's effectively looking for a raison d'etre. It isn't perhaps it for the reason it was developed, which is inhibiting bacteria. There are other cheaper drugs around. But for this, well, there's other more expensive, less effective drugs around. But if this thing lives up to its promise, it could be a fundamental game changer. So I hope that you'll stay tuned and tune in every week to follow this story with me. I'll be keeping my tentacles out on the internet and in the literature, watching to see how this develops. So more research, this one about bacteria. Researchers here were able to develop a vaccine that protects animals from salmonella, a very commonly lethal bacterial infection of the intestine. Now, salmonella is, it's gram-negative, which means it can trade DNA, so it can actually figure out a genetic fix to avoid the vaccine. The researchers, understanding how this works, and I'm going to break down the story for you in just a moment, managed to outsmart the bacteria, which is no easy thing to do. It's been hard to get vaccines against bacteria because bacteria are usually able to sidestep the vaccine's effectiveness by modifying their genes. There's a certain amount of random modification that takes place, and every now and then you get a spore that actually has a genetic adaptation, and that adaptation is protective because maybe it eliminates the thing that the vaccine was attacking, similar a little bit to what we're seeing with COVID, but this lets the pathogen escape the effects of vaccination. Sometimes it makes the bacteria less transmissible, but mostly they remain highly infectious. This kind of immune evasion has been a fundamental problem. This is why we don't have many bacterial vaccines. We have vaccines against tetanus toxin, but not against tetanus bacteria. We have vaccines against toxins and against surface markers, but we still don't have a decent vaccine against tuberculosis or HIV. It's really complicated to build a good vaccine. Researchers at ETH Zurich and the University of Basel have exploited this mechanism. They outsmarted the bacteria. They came up with a vaccine that, instead of trying to kill the bacteria, it guides their evolution in the gut to make them a weaker pathogen. So they're not causing it to die, they're causing it to be modified. They used it to drive evolution into kind of a dead end. They used mice with a series of slightly different vaccines and observed how the Salmonella modified its genes to escape the vaccine. They studied the moves of the bacteria, and they came up with a spectrum of all the possible immune evasions that they saw. Then they produced a combination vaccine from four Salmonella strains that basically covered all of the adaptations. So now the adaptations are blocked, and they had a surprise because the combined vaccine caused the sugar coating on the surface of the Salmonella to atrophy. They had no idea they were going to get this benefit. So while the bacteria were still able to multiply, they were unable to infect body tissues, unable to get into the bloodstream, and unable to cause severe disease. And that's because that sugar coating on the surface was part of the bacteria's protective coating that shields them from the host defenses, as well as shielding them from predatory viruses that are in the human gut. You did know that the microbiome has probiotics. You've also got proviruses that prey on the bacteria that would otherwise prey on us. Wow. Curiouser and curiouser, said Alice. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.